Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. And, Jim, there's been many different days where we've tried to shoehorn maybe not the greatest news into the good news martini. And this is good news simply for political reasons, potentially for the Republicans in 2012, because the New York Times, of all people, in a column written by longtime political reporter Tom Edsel, reports that the president has decided it's not even worth his time anymore to try and appeal to white working-class people, so therefore he's going to try and win re-election based on the highly educated hoity-toity liberal elite and pandering to minorities, mainly blacks and Hispanics. So this is basically the president's strategy. The people he claimed to be fighting for, the middle class, apparently that fight's over.
There are going to be days when depressing news for the country or frustrating news for the country is good news for the opposition party or whoever's out of power. And right now, the Republicans are out of the White House. And so, but sometimes you watch the opposition make a very bad decision. And this appears to be a bad decision in two ways. One is openly stating it, letting right. Thomas Edsel, garner enough evidence to make that argument. In a way, though, this isn't really that the Democrats are changing that much from what they've done in the past. This is a party that's had troubles with the white working class since at least Bill Clinton. And Obama has really only accelerated the trend. We saw this in 2008. We saw this in 2010. There is a certain cold-hearted rationalism to this, that the white working class as a proportion of the electorate is getting smaller and is slated to get smaller as the time goes by, based on demographic trends, etc. But this is still unwise, I would suspect, because one, it's kind of easy to forget. This is still a country that I believe is something close to 70-some percent white. It is easy to forget that there are a lot of key states that have large chunks of voters in this demographic. Ohio and Pennsylvania come to mind. I think Missouri you can put in this category. I think you can put New Hampshire in this category. But in a way, this is just kind of emphasizing what the Democratic Party has become. That if you're white working class, even I could argue white middle class, it doesn't have a lot to offer you. Because in the end, it is about transfer payments to the less fortunate, liberal social values, and even foreign policy, we've noticed, has kind of just dropped off the radar screen. For a while, this was a party that believed in that there was not a single problem in the world that could not be resolved without tough, smart diplomacy, as John Kerry kept insisting. Now we're killing people left and right in Yemen, and we're killing a bunch of Pakistani troops, and, the forecast over at least four or five countries is cloudy with a chance of drone attacks. Now, as a unrepentant hawk like myself, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I just marvel at the about-face that Democrats did. And, Obama can kill American citizens like Al Wacky with a drone, and everybody kind of shrugs their shoulders at it. And this is the sort of thing that if Bush did it would be considered evidence that the Constitution was going up in flames. So this is who the Democrats are. It's class warfare, and it's not explicitly race-based, but it is the underclass and the very tippy-top. And the folks who are in the middle and the working class, and even I think the, what they like to call them, the Henrys, the high earners, not rich yet category, which you find a lot of, I think, in parts of the country that aren't doing quite so badly, but maybe are living with a higher tax burden. The Democrats, in the end, don't really have much to offer them, and have just realized that it's not something that they like to spend a lot of time thinking about. They like thinking about these groups who can be dependent upon government, and these elites who can be making the decisions that that run the government. And that's who they are and what they're about, and everybody else can go pound sand.
I also think perhaps the good news here is that this actually came out of the New York Times. You'd think that them being in the hoity-toity ruling class type of position here, that they'd probably kind of try and keep that under wraps, maybe not make that such a prominent story. But kudos to them for doing it, and that's the reason we know about this strategy and the reason that it could be very beneficial to those trying to install a new president following next year's elections. On to martini number two now, and this is a martini type that we've revisited a number of times in recent weeks, and it's once again Herman Cain. For the most part, of course, we have been talking about him and sexual harassment allegations, the proof of which has still yet to have been offered. But nonetheless, we have a slightly different story now. The local Fox affiliate in Atlanta coming up with this story on Monday with a woman named Ginger White, who Cain acknowledges knowing but denies her allegation, as you'll hear in a second, that they have had a very long extramarital affair.
It was uncomplicated, and I was aware that he was married, and I was also aware that I was involved in a very inappropriate situation, relationship.
It was someone who was supposed to be a friend, but obviously they didn't see it as a friendship.
Now, when you say friend, was it an affair? I mean, I'm asking, these are awkward questions, but I'll ask you the questions you're going to be asked. Was this an affair?
No, it was not.
There was no sex?
No.
None?
No.
Now, perhaps if there's any good news here, Jim, it's that Kane actually responded to the story before it came out, so he's learned something from these previous allegations. His story on CNN to Wolf Blitzer was emphatic, just like with all these other allegations. Did not happen. He does acknowledge knowing the woman, says he tried to help her out financially. Subsequent investigations have shown that she has filed for bankruptcy, has had eviction notices, so she clearly had financial troubles at one time. She's been accused of slander at various times, and so you wonder if the credibility is there. The problem, though, for Herman Cain is that while he gave a very clear and vigorous denial to Wolf Blitzer on CNN, his attorney, Lynn Wood, supposedly the expert in this area, comes out with a very vague statement that basically says no individual, whether a private citizen, a candidate for public office, or a public official, should be questioned about his or her private sexual life. So I don't know if that's his way of trying to head off other possible public allegations from less than reputable sources, but after such a vigorous denial by Kane, such a weak paper statement from his attorney makes one wonder a little bit.
Greg, I want you to listen to me. I'm only going to say this once. Herman Cain did not have strategic discussions with his lawyer at all. They've never had these types of discussions. There was never any discussion of how to handle more accusations. So let's get that out of the way. No. Trying to evoke Bill Clinton's phrasing in that.
Right.
Look, once again, it's a, you know, two claims. Apparently, this woman has said she had a large stack of documents that will kind of verify the interaction they had. There are Herman Cain defenders who, when I did not, you know, I and actually a bunch of other conservatives, Politico wrote about this, Phil Klein and Guy Benson and a bunch of folks who did not come out and say, oh, this is all a pack of lies from, you know, liberals in the media. Once again, we don't know precisely what happened here. If we start seeing, you know, restaurant receipts or gifts or letters or emails or other things that kind of verify a romantic relationship between the two, then we will have a bit more tangible evidence here. I would just kind of observe. I'd ask everyone out there, maybe, you know, and Cain supporters won't want to hear this, but let's ask Occam's razor here. Is it possible that because he's such a powerful and influential and game-changing figure in American politics that an organized conspiracy of his former colleagues who don't like him and liberals have come together to put these accusations against him, that all of these women are lying? Or is it Occam's razor that perhaps many powerful men have turned out to be? Herman Cain has strayed and perhaps has, you know, a tendency to say things that are inappropriate to women in a working environment. I mean, you know, nothing has been proven quite yet, but by sheer volume of the complaints, if where are these complaints about Mitt Romney? Where are these complaints about Newt Gingrich? If this is some sort of liberal playbook, why are they only doing it against Herman Cain? And is that really the more plausible thing to happen here than the idea that, you know, maybe Herman Cain has not lived up to the standard that folks would like to see him live up to? I mean, you know, there are people who won't like to hear this, but at some point, how many women do we start saying this is all a giant, vast conspiracy of women who he used to know? I find it interesting that he decided to help her out financially. Maybe he's such a nice guy. It's kind of fascinating that he's so helpful to women, and then they turn around and accuse him of doing something sexual. Kind of fascinating, isn't it, Greg?
As you mentioned, Jim, we don't know. There's been, from Ann Coulter to a lot of other people, about the credibility of some of these people, but we simply do not know. And I think the differences between Republican and Democratic voters, yes, the problem exists just as much on the Republican side as the Democratic side, unfortunately, but Republicans definitely hold their candidates, I think, to a higher standard as a result of this sort of thing, because they feel if their spouse can't trust them, then why in the world should voters be able to trust them? And ultimately, that's what happens to a lot of Republican politicians who make that horrific mistake and ruin their family in that way.
Yeah, well, but one other thing just kind of note as a interesting wrinkle in all this. Yesterday on Twitter, as this news was breaking, I kind of responded by scoffing, God, you know, Greg, this is so November 8th. I mean, you know, last 3 weeks, Herman Cain has seen a pretty considerable dip in his numbers. And so while the truly cynical might be that this is the Herman Cain campaign going back to what works best, which is denying allegations of sexual misconduct, that's what got him up so high. It's kind of fascinating. This is not a desperate attempt to stop a roaring success of the Cain campaign. In a way, it almost feels kind of anticlimactic that, you know, perhaps, you know, Cain's moment as the flavor of the month has passed. Newt Gingrich is enjoying, and as I, you know, cynically suggested, no, no, no. This was the week for the women to come out about allegations of misconduct on the part of Gingrich's part. Who missed that memo? So we will see what shakes out here. I have a feeling from your stunned silence, Greg, that my cynicism about these matters shocks and horrifies you, and perhaps it's best to move on to the crazy martini, and rather revealing that this didn't qualify as the crazy martini for this week.
Yeah, exactly, given what we've seen, and we've seen this before, and in fact from the very same publication. The third martini today, or crazy martini, focuses on the Washington Post. For those of you who go to read the Fix column, Chris Saliza, who's prominently on MSNBC and some other places, is kind of the head of that, but other people work on the column, including Aaron Blake, who tweeted, "Hey, Tweebs, looking for outlandish slash incorrect predictions and quotes from Newt Gingrich's past. Any ideas for me?" And, of course, just a few months ago, we had this massive wave of people led by the Washington Post heading up to Alaska to go through Sarah Palin's emails and memos, and the Washington Post, among others, was asking people to, "Hey, why don't you volunteer to help us sift through Sarah Palin's emails and find something scandalous about her," which, of course, nobody did. So way to go, Washington Post, for being lazy and completely biased.
You know, Greg, I have a really good one, which was that he said about a year after the stimulus was passed, we should see really good results. Wait, that was President Obama. Oh, that was a wildly wrong prediction that President Obama, I think. You know, this is not the most outrageous concept for a story. Andrew Ferguson over at the Weekly Standard read every single one of Newt Gingrich's books, which I believe got up to like 18 or 19 of them. And he observed that in every Newt Gingrich book, at least the nonfiction ones, I know he's written some historical fiction, we are at a crossroads. And then a year or two passes and we're still at a crossroads. And then another year or two passes and we're still at a crossroads. And the options are always, you know, between social turmoil and a great innovative future. Technology is always the answer. And there's certain themes that come through. And you can kind of hook. You just kind of figure at some point in the past, you know, 20 years, 30, 25 years, Greg, that maybe we're not at a crossroads, or maybe it just means that we're always at a crossroads, and saying that at this moment we're at a crossroads is nothing particularly meaningful to say. So there's room to make fun of the rhetorical tics and overwrought language that, you know, Gingrich will use. But the fact that this, you know, Post reporter felt the need to say, "Hey, world, let's find out, you know," that he's never interested, or there's no sign that he's interested in offering similar mockery of other candidates. And this is why conservatives are, I think, often rightfully skeptical of the mainstream media. And I think it probably what's revealing is I don't think anybody at the Post, it would have seemed unusual to them to do it for one kind of candidate and then not do it for the incumbent Democrat or for, you know, other Democrats.
Dan Foster, while you were on the cruise, also made the point, you really don't need to look around for Newt Gingrich's skeletons. You just got to dust off the old ones. He's got plenty that you really don't have to do a whole lot of digging. But perhaps the old ones aren't having the negative effect that some folks at the Washington Post and the DNC were hoping for, because they've already been covered. So they have to try to go after some new stuff if they can find it. So.
Greg, one good way of putting it is that Newt Gingrich's, you know, skeletons have been around for so long that they're actual skeletons.
On that note, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again tomorrow for the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch.